Hi, welcome to Off Script. I'm Zach Lewis.
And I'm Dr. Draper.
Today, we are talking about Megalopolis. I'm so excited to talk about Megalopolis, dude. Francis Ford Coppola's epic is finally here. We have been talking about the makings of this movie for weeks, months even. Like, long-time listeners of the show know we've very much been looking forward to Megalopolis. Is it a flop? Is it a hit? Or is it something more? We're going to talk about it. We're also going to take a look at Oddity. This movie finally hit Shudder, a, like, almost micro-budget horror indie feature from writer-director Damien McCarthy. It is something. So we're going to talk about Oddity here in a minute. No spoilers. We don't do that on this show. Trailer Park coming up. We got a couple trailers to talk about, including that new Robert Eggers Nosferatu trailer. Oh, boy. And Ana de Armas is making her debut. Oh, dude, I know. And Ana de Armas is making her debut in the John Wick universe in Ballerina. We're going to tell you what's going on in there in between our segments. And before we get to all of it, we need to talk about the news. Our first story this week, it's finally happening, Andy. Disney's cracking down on password sharing. Disney Plus is launching a broad password sharing initiative. They're offering a paid extra family member option for like $10 a month. Is this the way it's going to be? Are all streaming services just going to have extra paid members and we all get nickel and dimed? I mean, what's going on here?
So, well, we failed as a populace to stop this because last year, Netflix did this about a year ago, year and a half ago. They introduced like forcing people to pay memberships and everyone got angry and was like, I'm canceling my account. And some people did. But most people didn't. And not only did most people not cancel, but most people, what they hoped would happen, signed up for their own account. And so it was a net positive to institute these crackdowns on sharing. They made more money. And so it had people stood their ground, we might have defeated it, but we didn't. And so now Disney Plus is now adopting this method as well, and the details are you can add one person and only one person to your household account for $10 a month, which I guess I don't pay for Disney Plus anymore. It must be like $17 now. So it's expensive to add a person, and you can only do it if you are only subscribed to Disney Plus. If you have a bundle package like Disney Plus, Hulu, ESPN, you don't get to do it. So it's only one person, it's $10, and it's only for Disney Plus. It's probably going to work again. Yeah. Another time we should be outraged and put our foot down. People are going to do it.
Yeah. It's like a law of large numbers thing. Way more people are just going to be prone to pay the extra than actually go to the trouble to quit. And by that means Netflix and Disney and any other streaming service doing this is continuing to race to the middle of American consumerism, right? Like we're not really catering to the best. We're not catering to the worst. We're just getting people who are too lazy to do anything different. And those are the kind of consumers you want to build any kind of reputable business. Yeah, you're not far off on the pricing, Andy. Effective October 17th, Disney Plus is going up just here in, what, next month. Disney Plus Basic with ads is going to go from $7.99 to $9.99. Disney Plus Premium no ads is going from $13.99 to $15.99 a month. $16 a month. They're also hiking the prices of Hulu, ESPN, and its multi-service bundles. I've been a Disney Plus subscriber since it came out. I'm kicking it after October. I'm done. I was going to kick it in October, but they got a couple of Halloween watches that I really enjoy, so I'm going to save it through the month, and then I'm out, dude. They can have it for Christmas. I don't care. Like, I'm done with it. I would kick Hulu. That's the other one I have from them, but I do actually get a lot of other stuff from them. I know FX is over there, and, you know, just a bigger, broader library, I think. But, yeah, I can't do it anymore. I can't do Disney Plus for, like, $16 a month. There's no way. It was $8 when it launched. Do you remember? We were doing this show. $8. No, my God, what a deal.
I know. It was cheaper than every other service initially.
Yeah. Is this just the way it's going to be? I mean, what? I was going to say, is this the way it's going to be? Of course it is. Are there any services that aren't doing this? HBO, I think, is doing the no password thing. Like, Netflix is definitely doing it. Disney and
HBO
Hulu.
Hasn't gotten there yet.
Okay. It's probably all right. Coming. Still some time. Sure. Apple limits you by devices. They got me when I tried to share my Apple password and they were like, double check a thing on your iPhone that's connected to your Apple account. I was like, oh God, okay. So that one's hard,
next.
But I think it's doable. I know. Like it's
well, the other thing is this drives people back to piracy. They always have to remember that there is always gonna be an option for people to pirate things.
Yeah, and it's easier now than ever before, man. There's a lot of free TV websites out there. It doesn't take a lot of Googling to find something streaming the thing you want, but, you know, anyway, that's where we're at on Disney. Anything else on this one before I move on?
I'm ready to go.
Quick announcement. Not much to this story. God willing, not much to this story. Martin Scorsese isn't making movies anymore. Well, he is, we think. But his Frank Sinatra biopic and his Life of Jesus film have both been postponed functionally indefinitely. Don't know why. No reason given. Variety reported this. It's a frightening thing for Scorsese fans out there. What do you mean he's not making these movies? He'd been talking about working on these for a long time. Life of Jesus was reportedly connected to Andrew Garfield, who he had worked on. It was in Silence with him.
Silence.
Yeah, like there was some kind of stuff up in the air. He's making this Frank Sinatra biopic. Variety learned that both of these were postponed. Neither's filming. Andy, is Killers of the Flower Moon potentially Scorsese's last film? Because that would really be a bummer. I mean, it's a great movie, but like that would be a bummer.
I mean, it would be a great last film. Let's hope he has one or two more left in him. Yeah, it's unfortunate because these sound like they would be incredible pieces of film. The Life of Jesus one might still be quietly in production, but it seems like the Frank Sinatra biopic has just been completely removed from the slate.
Yeah, which is frightening because that one was actually supposed to start first. That they were aiming for a November start date for filming on that. Now it is just not happening. We have no announcements on when they will be coming down the pipe. Let's remember, Scorsese is 81 years old. He's got a lot of executive producer credits. He's still doing stuff. All right, he's not out. He's even collaborating with Steven Spielberg on a Cape Fear TV series for Apple TV Plus. So there's some things going on. But it's weird, man. It's weird. And I saw this story and thought, ooh, you know what? I better put a pin in this just in case, God forbid, we hear some news later on developments with Scorsese. But keep it here for more. Here's a story Andy knows a lot about, actually. They're making a Batman villain movie? What is this about, Andy?
Right. Not Batman as the villain. But two high-profile villains are going to be teaming up, and we're going to get a bad guys movie starring Bane and Deathstroke. I almost said Deadshot. Deathstroke, which are two kind of Batman's nemesis throughout the comics. Bane, of course, famously played by Tom Hardy in 2012's The Dark Knight Rises, gave an iconic performance, voice, body, physique, all of it. I mean, Bane is still quoted to this day. The Bane accent is still, it's in the show. Like if you watch the like the animated shows on HBO, they still kind of do like the mock Bane voice, the darkness is your ally kind of thing. So they're still doing that. That's how iconic that performance is. Deathstroke was supposed to show up in Zack Snyder's Justice League universe at some point. He's teased at the very end of that movie in like the post credits thing for one scene, and that it never happened, which is really funny. But they're going to be teaming up in James Gunn's larger DC universe. We don't know who that's going to be. It's going to be really interesting to see who they cast, because Tom Hardy gave such an iconic performance as Bane that you're going to need another really stellar performance. And to catch people up, Bane is like this person born in a prison in a fictional like Caribbean island, South American. Is kind of a lucha. He kind of is luchador inspired, but he's on this drug called Venom that makes him super super strong. In the comics, he canonically broke Batman's back, essentially disabling him, defeating him for a number of years until he finally made a glorious comeback. But it's an iconic character. I don't know as much about Deathstroke other than he looks cool. He's just like a master assassin, and I don't know much about his motivations or what, but I think this will be a cool movie. I mean, we've seen the villain stuff work really well with things like Joker and Venom. Like, people love a good bad guy.
Yeah, they really do. And like, it seems like this is going to work like gangbusters. Not only are there properties in comic books that are having a lot of success with villain projects, namely Sony and their Spider-Man villain projects like Venom and even Morbius, Kraven. Madam Web, Kraven the Hunter coming out soon. Right. But DC also has success with spin-off projects. In the animated space, they've got that Harley Quinn show that's going on like its fourth season or something, and that's all villain-centric, and it kills. They've been doing Teen Titans forever, which has a bunch of villains moving in and out of it. James Gunn even made a show, Peacemaker, right? Peacemaker is fundamentally a villain of his Suicide Squad film, made a whole show out of him. It's getting a season 2. Like, For all intents and purposes, this is going to work great. Like, I don't see why this wouldn't work. And I would imagine if you get some creativity behind it that's lacking in Sony's Spider-Man villain verse, you're probably going to have something with some real heat, right? Like, why not? Why not have a team-up movie with two goofy Batman villains, right? I think it'll be a good time. But what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's got a lot of potential. Casting is going to be very choice, like whoever you get. Bane is supposed to be this, you know, hulking, like, muscled up. I always think of, he was played by Tom Hardy, who did bulk up for the role, but I always think of someone like the Mountain from Game of Thrones, Hafthor Bjornsson, who's like 6'9 and 400 pounds. Like, you got to get a guy like that to play Bane. But it's hard to find guys that big who are actors. So, but it could be a career defining role. So I'm definitely excited about that.
Yeah, me too. Keep it on off-script for more. We will report back on this Batman Villains project. One more story this week before I move into Megalopolis from the box office. Andy, I think you should tell people this one. What happened with Megalopolis at the box office? Did it soar or did it crash?
Megalopolis is a megaflopolis, as predicted by everyone, honestly, not just us. We figured that this movie would not do well, and it has come in at a scant $4 million on a $120 million budget. No one would pick up this movie. Coppola had to pay for distribution and marketing out of his own funds. Lionsgate agreed to help with distribution, but they're not losing any money over it. No one wanted to touch this, and we see why. Hugely expensive. It's a big bond. It's got a D-plus cinema score, which is harsh. Overly harsh, I think. We'll talk about it more soon. The big winner of the weekend was The Wild Robot, the animated film, which we're actually going to be watching next week. Came in at $35 million. A little unprecedented. It's kind of got the audience that Transformers 1 didn't pick up last week. It's been wildly successful, very... it's a four-quadrant film. It's family-friendly. It's been well-reviewed, all those good things. And so it's coming in... really good this week.
I'm going to have to apologize for listeners of the show for not watching Wild Robot this week. I'm going to see it this week. Andy has already seen it, and he's holding off reviewing it for me so we can do it next week. So stick around. We will cover Wild Robot. I keep hearing it's awesome. Quick soundbite, Andy. What do you think? Good. Thumbs up, thumbs down?
Strong recommend.
Oh, dang. Oh, all right. Cool. I hadn't talked to you about it yet. All right. Well, then next week we'll watch Wild Robot. In the meantime, yeah, everybody knew Megalopolis was going to be a flop, which is kind of a charming way to experience the story of this movie because, you know, it's much like the making of how this movie got made. The story in Megalopolis kind of echoes Coppola's attempt to get this thing off the ground, right? This huge, dreamlike, surreal project that nobody understands, but the creator itself says, you know what? I can do it. I'll go forward. If nobody will build a better future, then damn it, I'll do it. and here's what we've reached at the end of it. But that might be the best segue into Megalopolis because I'm really looking forward to talking about it. I'm going to be taking the summary on it. But anything else from the box office before we move in, Andy?
Not box office, but I did have a small announcement about how I went viral over the weekend.
Oh, God, I forgot. Yeah, dude. Oh, you got to tell people about this. Yeah.
So after, one of the things I like to do, I'm still old school in that I like to have a ringtone and a text tone because I leave my ringer on. And I make custom sounds, usually for movies, stuff, soundtracks. And like my text tone has been the Spider-Man 99 sound bite forever. And now I decided to make this little sound from The Substance, if Zach is going to play it.
I can't play the audio through here. I can pull it up on video. Okay. If you're watching, you can see
which is this very short bite where it goes like burr. And it's very iconic in the movie. And I decided to make that my ringtone. And I posted a video on Twitter of me using that sound. And I tagged the director, Coralie Farjay. And she retweeted me, as did The Substance account itself. The movie account also retweeted me. And then I ended up getting like tons of 2,000 likes, a ton of reshares and saves. People asking, oh, how do I do that? How do I get it in my phone? Can I get the file? So I felt famous. I felt like I could tweet my way into Hollywood. It's been a crazy 48 hours. But I'm glad everyone liked it and that I wasn't like fighting with everyone online.
Yeah, 89.5 thousand impressions. Imagine if you had Twitter Blue, you'd be killing it. And not a single plug for Off-Script Film Review, by the way, but it's okay. You were basking in the glory. And by the way, fairly helpful in the comments. Everybody wanted to know how to do it. You explained in one tweet that, hey, it's not easy. This is kind of how you do it. Then you actually uploaded the MP4 direct in the thread. If you want to find this, you got to go follow Andy at DrDrape8VB. Is that supposed to be Dr. Draper something, or what is the 8VB?
Sorry, that's a music reference. 8VB means like drop the octave, like you play something an octave lower than.
Shows how much I know.
It's music nerd speak.
Well, I think it's great. Yeah, kudos on the hit tweet. You outpaced me by a mile. I've definitely never hit a tweet that did that good. Well done.
I definitely forgot that, to plug the show. I should have.
Wow. That's what you always see. Anytime somebody's got a hit tweet, the first reply is like, oh yeah, here's something I can plug that you might be able to follow. And like, I can't say anybody would have, but I mean, come on, this is good stuff. With that, we should move into our review of Megalopolis. God, I'm going to be taking the summary on this one, so please excuse any clumsy delivery from me. The movie is Francis Ford Coppola's Megalopolis. So, in Megalopolis, the city of New Rome is hosting a conflict between Caesar Catalina, a brilliant artist in favor of a utopian future, and the greedy mayor Franklin Cicero. Between the two of them is Julia Cicero, her loyalty divided between her father and her beloved Caesar Catalina. A full cast of very exciting characters. Megalopolis is a 2-hour, 20-minute epic from Francis Ford Coppola, director of The Godfather, Apocalypse Now, Bram Stoker's Dracula, and it is something. Man, people have talked about this movie might be brilliant. People have said it's the worst thing they've seen all year. We've really been looking forward to watching it. And in our film, I want to get to, before we talk about how it's actually made, the story inside the movie. Caesar Catalina is played by Adam Driver, this exciting architect working with this brand new material he's invented that he won the Nobel Prize off of, and he wants to build a new city, a new utopia out of the ruins of New Rome, a city that very much looks like New York City, but is Rome, right? It's Roman. It's this kind of mirrored version of America that we're looking at, very patriotic. Of course, Mayor Cicero is played by Giancarlo Esposito, who is a classic mayor and wants nothing to do with this new way of life. He thinks New Rome's great. In fact, he wants to build a new big casino instead of a park because that's going to bring people in, right? Natalie Emmanuel plays his daughter, Julia Cicero. She is falling for this Caesar Catalina character, right? This black-clad architect who works at the top of the Empire State Building. And of course, there's Aubrey Plaza playing WoW Platinum, who's been getting a lot of attention on Twitter over the weekend. This local debutante who has a show on television where she keeps up with the stock market and interviews the mayor and Caesar Catalina and really has her own means. Additionally, we've got Shia LaBeouf as Claudio Pulcher, who is quite the individual, the son of John Voight's character Hamilton Crassus III, who is the richest man in New Rome, owns all the banks. Shia LaBeouf's Claudio is a wreck. He hangs out with his sisters all the time and does drugs and parties, just the classic, like, dad gave me everything kind of kid. And lastly, rounding out the cast, we've got Lawrence Fishburne as Fundi Romaine, who is Caesar's driver and also the narrator of our picture. Not quite Morpheus, but he got just a little bit of that Morpheus energy from The Matrix. And one of the most interesting things about Metropolis is how it was made. The story of how Metropolis has come together, Megalopolis, good Lord, is how it was made. The story of how it came together and how we're getting to see it on screen. Despite the fact that it's not making money, it's Coppola's vision, and by God, he's going to put it out there for the world. And I want to talk about that. But first, we need to talk about the movie, the actual film, the 2 hours and 20 minutes that we watched. Andy, what did you think of Megalopolis?
So it's a complicated thing. I think overall, I enjoyed it. And I kept needing to, about halfway through, I needed to use the restroom, and I just couldn't get up because I was like, well, I feel like something important is happening and I don't want to miss it. And that happened through the most of the film. It is indulgent. It is Baroque. It is so much. It kind of doesn't make a lot of sense, but I kind of enjoyed it, and I have to commend the attempt. This is how great art is made, is by pushing limits, by turning everything up to 11. And sometimes it doesn't work. Most of the time it doesn't work when you go to the extremes, but there are bits of brilliancy in this. And I think more importantly, it's the kind of thing that will inspire others. Like if I were a director or a film student, like I would absolutely demand that people go see this, because it would only inspire your own storytelling, your own filmmaking. I think there's things that work. I think there's a lot that probably doesn't. I don't know who I could recommend this to, but at the same time, I almost feel like I need to recommend it to everyone because I like people to be challenged in the cinema. It reminded me of, it was very Shakespearean because the way people talk, and it's like a modern Shakespeare, almost like Romeo and Juliet, Baz Luhrmann's version of that. Also was reminded of Julie Taymor's Titus, which is based on the Shakespeare play Titus Andronicus, which starred Anthony Hopkins way back in the day. It's like from the late 90s. But it's a similar movie where it's Shakespearean, but everything else is modern. And it reminded me of this. I don't really know what this is kind of about ultimately, but it's such a big spectacle. I mean, I couldn't look away from the screen. And it's the kind of thing like I would watch this again. I would revisit it again. But let's get into it.
Yeah, so I think it's important to talk about really quick for people at the top, and I want to talk about how it was made more at the end, but just briefly, if you're just stepping in here, if you haven't been listening to the show, if you don't know anything about Megalopolis, like you just saw a trailer or something and you're curious about this new Adam Driver movie that's out, let me give you the quick 60 seconds at the top. Francis Ford Coppola is functionally retired from directing. He owns a bunch of wineries. You've seen his wine around. They're in black bottles with gold rims, red wines. Good wine. He wants to make one more feature, Megalopolis. This movie has been dreaming about making for years, right? This film about an architect who builds this new utopia out of the ruins of a failing society, right? And he basically sells a bunch of wineries, puts $120 million into making Megalopolis, self-funds it like his other features, hires Driver and a bunch of other people who can't wait to work with him. And there's stories coming from the set that it's god-awful. He has no idea what he's doing. He's just pointing cameras in random places and the actors are doing their best and it's maybe coming together. We talked about it here on this show. Finally, screeners come out and nobody wants to buy it to distribute. Lionsgate eventually jumps on it and they put out a trailer. The trailer is made with AI and is half fake. They have to retract it and fire their PR company and high end may put out a new one. They put out a new trailer. Finally, Megalopolis comes out with everybody saying it's going to be a flop. Statistically, there's no way this movie's going to do good. It's going to do terrible. We don't really know who it's for. But Coppola says, you know what? It's for me. That's why I'm making this movie, because I've wanted to make it forever, and by God, I'm going to do it. And the themes of the film echo his story. So I want to talk about that at the end, but I just wanted to get that out front for people who are maybe not sure what the rundown is for Francis Ford Coppola. That's how he came about making Megalopolis, wrote and directed himself. Everything's come from him, the money, the decisions. He is the creative masterwork behind this thing. And I think at the end of it, once having actually seen the film, I can say that Coppola still has it sometimes. He still has it sometimes.
Yeah.
Because there are moments in this film. Yeah, there's sequences. There are shots that look so grand. Stuff that would be in Best Picture of the Year. Like, incredible work. There's other sequences that are so awful and so bad, you can't believe they're still in the movie. Like, how did you guys leave this in? There are whole scenes that are brutally ADR'd with characters on screen, which is always a quick indication that they put this together in editing, they cut a scene, they're filling for time. There's people have abilities, supernatural abilities that they can use at the beginning of the film that they never use for anything relevant throughout the runtime ever. And then it just kind of comes up again at the end. Baffling decisions. Stuff that all leads to these stories from the set. That Coppola doesn't really have a clear vision. He doesn't know exactly what he's doing. It's a lot for one man to hold and put together. And I see all that. But I also see the brilliance of it. And I also see this creative streak from a man who had functionally otherwise stepped away from filmmaking to say, you know what? I got one more in me. I'm going to come out for it. And in that way, Megalopolis is a really fun watch. But if I didn't know any of that, if I had just bought a ticket and wandered into this movie like, oh yeah, okay, I'll check that movie out, whatever. I got a few hours to burn at the theater. I think I would have been really disappointed. And I think that's where most people are coming out on Megalopolis.
Yeah, I mean, your mileage will vary for sure. But Yeah, and I'm not real sure what he's trying to say. You know, it's kind of about the future. It looks very, like, Ayn Randian. Everyone's in weird neo-Roman garb. Like, everyone has, like, a little Caesar haircut, which is kind of funny, and has, like, Roman, like, kind of armor, but it still has, like, regular clothes and drive regular cars. There is this substance, this, like, supernatural or super material called a megalon, which Caesar is attempting to build, like, this utopian part of the city, and a, like, a destroyed part of New York, would now call New Rome, out of this miracle substance called megalon. That, you know, he's like, we will build a utopia, it will be better, there will be a city on a hill, all those kinds of things. And everyone's like, no, you're not really going to do that. Like, there's conflicting interests, but it's kind of unclear what they are. The daughter, Julia, played by Natalie Emmanuel, she's kind of the bad girl of the mayor. She falls in love with Caesar. Shia LaBeouf's character wants him to inherit the bank, but he's like the powers that be, like father and uncle, are like, no, you're too wild, you're too, you know, whatever, you'll never be anyone. And so he has his own, like, revenge schemes. It doesn't really make a whole lot of sense, but at the same time, I couldn't look away, and I was like, I'm here for the ride. I was glued to it the whole time.
Yeah, it's got a weird structure. Like, I realized about halfway through it, I was like, I don't think this is a three-act structure. And I actually think it is, having seen the whole thing. I think it's just executed poorly. But for people who go see movies a lot, like Andy and I, and I don't know, any other critics, anybody else doing a movie podcast that you know, it is wildly different, because it is not predictable. Like, you can't predict where it's going next, because Coppola's all over the map. It seems to take place over the course of, I think, a year. You seem to have kind of consistent season changes throughout the film, but it doesn't feel like it, and events are not displayed as if they happen over 1 year. It could be five, for all I know. Like, some characters will have a conversation, and then the seasons will change, and they'll be having the other half of that conversation, but two characters may have died in between there. And I'm like, when did this all happen? Like, the passage of time is strange. Additionally, New Rome looks terrible. It is a mix of... It looks so bad. It is a mix of, like, stock footage of New York with some color grading. Yeah. And stuff that, like, Coppola shot out in the streets, which looks good. Yeah, you'll have, like you said, these characters with these, like, Roman haircuts and these, like, gilded stuff and these, like, big toga dresses, you know, out partying and having a good time. And it'll cut to a stock footage shot of, like, people getting on the subway in New York, and then, like, the skyline with a building that has the MetLife logo on it. It's so goofy. Yeah, it's like, what am I looking at here? And the film explains this through narration by Lawrence Fishburne, which is solid, by the way. And title cards, these big, like, etched in stone looking marble title cards that will pop up. It even opens with one when it explains that, like, we are in New Rome. It is the 21st century. It is not quite like the world we live in. It's a little bit different. You know, it's patriotic and it's America, but it's not America. And Coppola seems to have cooked up that, like, telling this story of, like, the revitalization of America through the eyes of a Roman Empire, like, echoes through time and also is a little bit more universal for audiences overseas. Because I think this movie ultimately is about, like, the world and humanity. Like, it's less about, like, America versus everyone else. And this, like, giving it that kind of Roman zeal gives it a little bit of style and a little bit of flair without, I think, removing it from everybody in the world. Like, theoretically anybody could watch Megalopolis, even though it is a uniquely American tale.
Yeah, it really is, and Coppola has said that this is kind of a bit of a parallel to the upcoming election, which isn't...
Oh, yeah. Oh, dude.
Which I'm like, oh, God, please don't make those kind of parallels. But yeah, it's about, like, his central thesis, while I don't think it's really executed very well, is, you know, about building a better future, thinking about the future, not just the now. Like, we have to envision things to be so much better than they are, or dream bigger than reality. These kinds of very high and mighty platitudes and ideas. It's still kind of its own bizarre thing, though.
Yeah, on top of the stock footage, like, it uses a lot of montage with this, like, yeah, weird three split, like, frame that Coppola just starts using in the movie and then just continues through the rest of the movie. Like, you put two lines down the thirds of the frame, and then you have three different images going, and it'll be Adam Driver building some kind of thing out of Megalon, and then Adam Driver like in his office, like pacing back and forth, and then like somebody holding up a blueprint, and then another one will cut to, it's like these montages of like stuff happening without actually showing you anything that's happening. Like, this extends notably to Adam Driver's profession as this kind of architect. It's a whole lot of him pacing in his office, but you never see him like actually building anything out of this stuff.
Yeah,
you do see it. Tearing they do have this lot. Like, yeah, it's like this floating gem substance material that sometimes reflects images and sometimes doesn't. And then he's like talking about building a thing and stressing about building the thing. And he's at the office late at night again, building the thing. But you know, like, he never does anything. This stuff just kind of gets built off screen, which is really baffling. And it's not nearly as straightforward as our antagonists in John Voight as Crassus and his son Shia LaBeouf as Claudio, and even a little bit of Aubrey Plaza as Wow Platinum, who's great, by the way. She's a lot of fun. Both are very on the nose characters. Crass and Claude are their names. Good God, like, they're not nearly as classy as Caesar Catalina, right? The esteemed architect.
Yeah, I was certain this was kind of going to do a Julius Caesar thing, and he was going to get. They were all going to surround him and kill him. But it's not that kind of story. Aubrey Plaza is great as this. She's kind of the social climber. She's initially in a relationship with Adam Driver's Caesar. But then she quickly marries John Voight's banker character because she's positioning herself. She also seeks power and money, and so she's kind of jumping from relationship to relationship as whatever benefits her. As opposed to Natalie Emanuel's very kind of like, oh, I'm here about true love, and like, I'm here to challenge Adam Driver. Tell me go back to the club. Which is a great line from them.
Yeah, though the movie's full of great line reads. It really feels like Coppola just picked like the wackiest line reads out of every take he got. Like, just whoever, if Dustin Hoffman says something weird, that's the one I'm using. Adam Driver says, go back to the club, I'm using that one. Like, and so the movie's full of it. Like, it's a really good cast saying the oddest damn things. Like, it's really something.
Giancarlo Esposito as Mayor Cicero is great, and finally not just being a Gus Fring style role and character. He has so much more dimension in this as the rival mayor who is corrupt and all those things, but he kind of represents like the way things are and kind of the status quo and what has always worked and will always work, and you can't build a better future because there is no better future to build. Like, everyone is so Shakespearean in their character, and like, a lot of people walked away from this film, like Zendaya walked away, other high profile actors, but the cast is stacked, and it's like, these people, like, you don't do the film if you don't believe in it and you're like the leads, like all these people are, and I feel like all these people wanted to be involved. I mean, also people like Chloe Fineman, who is primarily on Saturday Night Live, it has a small role in this because it's like, well, she got to work with Coppola, and there's a few people like that in this. Like, people just wanted to be attached to the project, even if it's an utter disaster in the end.
Yeah, definitely. Dustin Hoffman's in it. Yeah. Adam Driver talked about that in an interview. He said working with Coppola was one of his most pleasant experiences ever on set. He's like, God, he's so collaborative. He wanted to work with me on everything. He wanted to get involved. Meanwhile, Giancarlo Esposito's having a good time. God, he's talked about in interviews how tired he is of playing Gus Fring. It is a delight seeing him play something different and something exciting, even if his character looks like he fell straight out of Joel Schumacher's Batman, along with every other press reporter in this movie. They're wearing like fedoras with like little bills sticking out that's like extra, you know, like, it's great. Like, they look so goofy, and I like that New Rome is crumbling. Things are not going good in New Rome. There's poverty, there's problems, buildings are falling down and being demolished, and the mayor is like, no, everything's good, vote for me, you know. That's a lot of fun. And then of course there's Caesar Catalina, who's like, no, things are really bad and we got to do something different. He's definitely pompous, he's definitely preachy, he's definitely over the top. His dialogue reads like Coppola's personal manifesto, and like, it is difficult to keep up with. But Driver is a ton of fun, dude. He's a ton of fun. I saw this movie, I watched it Sunday mornings. There's almost nobody in my theater. A couple people in the back. One woman who I think was about our age sitting just a couple seats down from me in like the middle, and then me. That woman, couple seats down, huge driver stand. Dude, she was dying laughing at this movie. It's probably the funniest comedy she'll watch all year. She thought he was so funny. Like, his line reads are honest and genuine, and like, there's definitely some funny bits unintentionally in Megalopolis, which I think adds to the experience for people like us who are going to see something different.
Yeah, it's really fun. I wanted to just point out that Aubrey Plaza is having like a really great week because she's in this. She's in another movie called Mild Ass, where it's like a time travel thing with like she meets her younger self or something like that. She's also in Disney Plus Agatha All Along. So it's like season of Aubrey Plaza this like couple of weeks.
Yeah, and I'm so glad too, because when we watched that Child's Play remake, she's the mom in that, and I remember seeing her show up, and I thought, oh God, her career's over. Rip, it's done. Like, you're playing a mom character in a cheesy B movie remake. Like, oh no.
Pack it up.
And here she is, killing it. She's on Agatha All Along. She's in Megalopolis. Of course, Megalopolis is a flop, but hey, it's historic, right? And I think, like, to bring the conversation kind of full circle, like, regarding the way this movie's made, Andy, how do we square that with listeners? If you know the story of Coppola and how he got it made, I think you have a bit more respect for it. But objectively, by itself, I don't think Megalopolis is that good, right? Am I crazy? What do you think?
I think there's things to be praised and criticized. And like I said, I enjoy seeing a director like just pull out all the stops and just go to 11. I'm sure the accountants and at Lionsgate and stuff will be like, point to this and say, see, this is why we rein in directors, this is why we give studio notes so this kind of thing doesn't happen, because it, like, business wise no, it's a terrible thing, it's a disaster, but you make great art by constantly pushing your limits.
Yeah, you really do. And like, that's, I think ultimately, that's the story of Megalopolis, but also the story of how Megalopolis got made. Like, Megalopolis is not made because it's easy. It's not made because it makes the most money. Like, it's made because it's the natural extension of where humanity's going. And more importantly, it's made because art is made, the best art is made to challenge people, not to please. And this is something that Hollywood hates, man. Every Marvel movie is made to please. It's made to please as many people as possible, right? That's what Disney does. That's what Paramount, that's what everybody does. Universal, like, we're making stuff that's going to hit all quadrants. We're going to make as much money as possible, and it's going to go to streaming, and we're going to make... Megalopolis dares to say, no, I'm not doing it. I'm making this because I think it's weird, and I think it's cool, and yeah, it's expensive, but by God, it's mine. And Francis Ford Coppola put it out there. Now here he is. For every bad scene, I can think of an equal and opposite scene that would be used for like the Criterion Collection cover for Megalopolis.
Yeah.
Like, for everything I didn't like, there's something that's composed so perfect, that's put together so great. I can't help but say, of course, it came from Coppola. It's weird. It's a weird movie. And I don't know if I'll make it. It'll make my top 10 this year, but it's almost guaranteed for the new and noteworthy. It might be the most noteworthy picture of 2024. Like, because if you know what's happening here, you can't help but want to talk about it. It stirs conversation.
Yeah, I kind of felt the same way, like where there were parts where I was confused and not sure what we're doing. And there's this incredible, they did a Ben-Hur style horse racing thing when there's actual horses. And I'm just like, this is huge spectacle. I can't deny like the ambition of it, the vision of it.
Right. Yeah, it's just so odd. A really unique picture though. Man, I'm glad I watched it. Any other thoughts or recommendations, Andy?
I'm ready.
Andy, would you recommend Megalopolis?
So this is a complicated one. I would say save it for streaming, unless if you're really, really interested to see what he's trying to do for it. I would say it is best seen in the theater because it is such a visual kind of feast in a lot of ways. If you're a little skeptical, I would say save it for streaming. I do think it is worth checking out. I think it's important to challenge audiences. Probably don't recommend it for like your family watch on like Christmas dinner or Thanksgiving, something like that. But I think check it out, save it for streaming. May not be for everyone though.
Yeah, I think I'm gonna tell most people to pass on Megalopolis. I would say if you don't know anything about it, if you're not really interested, just wait for it to come to streaming and you can throw it on and you'll get 20 or 30 minutes into it and be like, what is going on here? And maybe you'll finish it and maybe you won't. I think it's something that like it spurns curiosity. You want to see what's going on in Megalopolis because you're just like, what is happening in this picture? And it's odd and it's strange, but I'm really glad I watched it. And I'm really glad Coppola made it. I hope it does get a Criterion Collection ad. Feels like it'd be perfect. And I know they need the money. So like, why not, right? Like, you might as well put this movie everywhere you can to try to get some people to watch it. So we'll see. I would love it if it made it in the vault. But man, that's Megalopolis. What a feature. And speaking of features, I'm excited to talk about these next couple. Andy, what do we call this segment?
It's time for the trailer park. So we're going to be bringing a couple of new trailers, the first of which is Ballerina from the world of John Wick. This is the first film spinoff from the John Wick universe. There was a TV show called The Continental, which focused on the hotel, which I think actually was kind of bad. I think it was on Peacock or Paramount, one of those. Not very good from what I hear. But Ballerina is the story of Ana de Armas plays Eve. If for those who don't know and aren't up to date on the lore of John Wick, there is a house of assassins that are all these Russian ballerinas called the Ruska Roma, and they're exactly what they sound. They're ballerinas slash assassins, and this is a story of Ana de Armas's character Eve getting recruited into this. We see her as a little girl approached by Ian McShane, who's kind of the person in charge. In all the John Wick movies, he plays Winston. Great voice. Love to see Ian McShane. He approaches Eve as a young girl. She's covered in blood. You know something bad's happened. The trailer tells us she's lost her father. And he says, how would you like to get revenge or come join, learn how to fight, all this? So she joins the Ruska Roma. They train her to fight, be an assassin. And I was a little unsure about this movie. But man, this trailer got me hyped because the action is top notch. And they acknowledge right away, they're like, you're smaller, you're weaker than all your targets. You have to fight differently. You have to fight dirty. You have to use weapons. And so we have Ana de Armas doing lots of gun fu, knife fu, lot like beating everyone up. It's great. And then we see a couple of cameos from John Wick because this is a kind of prequel movie. So Keanu Reeves will probably make a couple of appearances, and we also see the late Lance Riddick. So I was pretty excited about this comes out next summer. Zach, what do you think?
I think John Wick movies they have an audience. I think they're uniquely difficult to market because your trailer's got to show a bit of story, a bit of what's going on, and it's difficult to show like the tone. It's easy to show a bunch of like fast action flying at you, but I had not seen any John Wick movie all the way through until I went to John Wick 4 for the show. And like no trailer for John Wick 4 did that movie justice. Like no trailer will be able to show these long action sequences of back to back to back to back rad stuff you've never seen before. And the Ballerina trailer does a good job of swinging at it. But if this has the juice, if this has the gas, the riz of John Wick 4, dude, it's almost sure to be a hit. Like it looks great. Armas looks like she's having a ton of fun. Tons of action in the trailer, which already has two or three things that are worth giving and putting on Twitter. Like very, very impressive trailer for Ballerina. I hope the failure of that show, that Continental show, doesn't hurt this, because I do think there were some Wick fans that watched that and were like, boo, hiss, this sucks. So hopefully this has the juice that those other films do, and it'll have legs because it looks really solid. Andy, what do you think?
Yeah, like I said, I'm excited for it. Ana de Armas was also in that, I can't remember the name of that Netflix movie that we watched for the show, but there was... No, not that
Blonde,
one.
Right?
It was the action one with Chris Evans was in it. I can't remember, but she did. She Ghosted. She showed that she. No, not that one.
She, oh my god! Just, I'll stop. Go ahead.
She had a lot of action in that. That's what I'm getting at. Is that she had a ton of action in that role. The Gray Man. That's what it was.
She had tons of
action scenes in that role, fight scenes, gunplay, hand-to-hand combat, So we know that she can do it, and she's showing up in this, and it's some of the coolest stuff. She's breaking bones, she's shooting people, stabbing people a bunch of times. It's the kind of action you expect from John Wick now in the lovable Ana de Armas, who we all love on this show. So I'm definitely psyched for it. And this is due out, like I said, in the summer, June 6th. So at the beginning of the summer.
Yeah. Almost as exciting as this Christmas feature. We got to talk about the new trailer for Nosferatu. Dude, this movie just continues to look rad. I was a skeptic after Eggers put out The Northmen, and I thought, oh no. Oh no, an adaptation that's that doesn't quite work. Right. He might have lost a step here. And since then, I should say I need to go back and rewatch Northmen. A lot of people have told me it's worth revisiting. Might be true. But Nosferatu just continues to look rad. If you haven't seen the original or don't know anything about it, it's a gothic tale of obsession between a Han young woman and the terrifying vampire that's infatuated with her, that travels over the ocean and through the towns, leaving a horribly evil, bloody trail in its wake. It stars Lily Rose Depp, Bill Skarsgård as the vampire. We have Nicholas, who am I thinking
Holt.
Of? Nicholas Holt, that's it, as a character who looks terrified. Willem Dafoe appears to be something like a Van Helsing. Aaron Taylor Johnson is also in the film. Ralph Ineson is in it. Man, this looks like the kind of scary that Eggers is claiming, because he's been saying in interviews, he's like, I'm tired of watching vampire movies that aren't scary. I'd like to be scared watching a vampire movie. And like, dude, if he can get this right, mission accomplished. Like, this looks so good. This looks so fun. It comes out Christmas Day. Christmas Day. That, like, listen, you're not getting in there on the 23rd, all right? You're not getting in there before you go sit. Like, you got to wait. You got to go see this on the day. I might have to try to make it happen. Andy, what do you think of the trailer for Nosferatu?
I was already super hyped for this, but even more so now, just getting to see more of our cast and crew, which also includes Emma Corrin, Nicholas Holt, Ralph Ineson, Lily Rose Depp as kind of the I don't, not femme fatale. She's kind of the damsel in distress, or kind yes. of the doomed person in this. It just has an incredible look. Like, the vibes are just, it looks so dark. Everything is gray. It looks like everyone in the movie is just scared and terrified at all times. And I haven't actually seen the original Nosferatu. I definitely want to before this. But man, it looks so scary. It looks super creepy. And in a movie like this, in a director like this, it's going to be a, you know, I'm excited to see what it's about. Like, the way the witch and the lighthouse are, you know, very heavily thematic. I'd love to see what he's exploring through this story.
Yeah, same. It looks so creepy. And notably, you do not get a look at the creature, which I thought for sure was coming in this full trailer. When we saw the reveal trailer, you don't get a look at him really. And I was like, ooh, that's clever. They don't really show you the beast. And then here, same. You don't get a look at him. Like, oh my God, I'm so stoked, dude. I can't wait to go see this movie. Like, I love it. It seems to be firing all cylinders. Two quality trailers. And with that, we should jump into one more horror feature, actually. Maybe the perfect segue. Terrible segue, actually. Full disclosure. Awful. But I am excited to talk about this next feature. This is a small one. Andy, do you want to quick tell people how you heard about this originally? Because I had, like, we do a movie podcast. I didn't have this on my radar at all till you said something about it to me. And now we're here actually watching the thing.
I'd been hearing some buzz over the summer about this movie. People saying it was really scary, something different, you got to see it. And it had a small release in July or August. And now it's available on Shudder. So there was a lot of, like, kind of grassroots buzz, Twitter buzz about it. So I was really excited to get into it from that kind of just word of mouth.
Yeah. And well, with that, no better way to get into it. Andy, please take it away.
Oddity. I almost forgot that I was doing this summary.
Yeah, watch out.
Oddity takes place in Ireland, at this kind of secluded home castle that this couple is renovating. It's a doctor who works at this mental institution. His wife, Darcy, played by Carolyn Bracken, is there to, she's there for the remodel. It's remote, it's desolate, there's no phone signal. Right at the beginning of the film, she is implied she's brutally murdered by what seems to be an escaped mental patient, a very kind of cliche setup. The husband grieves, but also very quickly moves on to another relationship with one of his staff members. This is all suspicious to Danny, who is the twin sister of the woman who's murdered, also played by Carolyn Bracken. Danny is blind and owns an antique shop of oddities, where she claims to be a medium and a psychic and to be able to, you know, touch an object and see into its history, to have it tell something about her. She's not convinced that everything about her sister's murder is as was told. She wants to go out to the house and kind of bring some of her things along to help kind of solve this mystery, see if she can, as a blind woman, use her psychic abilities to kind of uncover the mystery that something may or may not be going on. And part of what she does is she brings this very creepy, like life-size wooden figure out to the secluded castle thing, which is really creepy for everyone involved. I think there's a lot of things that work in this film. I think there's some things that don't. But let's get into it. Zach, what'd you think?
So I liked Oddity, I think. I should say that up front. But my expectations were nil. I had heard this movie has no money. I didn't know anything about the director. I don't know anybody in the cast except for one person, Gwillem Lee, who played Brian May in Bohemian Rhapsody, and he's also Nicholas Holt's friend in The Great, the show on Hulu. That's it. I've seen that guy in two things, and I had forgotten about Bohemian Rhapsody. Other than that, I don't know anybody in it. I don't know anything about it. I just heard it was this cool kind of indie horror. So going in with that, great time. I actually had a great time. I thought it was a really simple premise, really clever, open. And I didn't know where it was going, but it pretty much got there. And I felt like, okay, that's good. That's good, like 90 minute little something. I think it's a movie that suffers from its own success. I think if you hear about it and your friends tell you to watch it and people are like, oh my God, you got to go see this new sleeper hit Oddity. That's probably too much. That's probably too much. But like for what's here, it's got good basics. I think it's a great follow-up after McCarthy's previous work, Caveat, which I have also not seen, but I hear that this is like growing on that. I should probably go back and visit that at some point. Like probably looking at a bigger feature with a bigger budget to follow this, I would imagine. Damien McCarthy's probably going to get some money. I'd imagine somebody like Lionsgate or somebody, Blumhouse, somebody will pick him up. Maybe they'll get a Marvel movie. Somebody's going to do something with what's here because I think Oddity hits the basics real good, but it is basic and that's okay. Like it's actually kind of funny. We're playing this opposite Megalopolis, but where do you want to start talking about this thing?
So I want to get into the plot. So I will also come out and say I was actually a little disappointed in this, surprisingly, because I was the one who was telling Zach, I was like, yeah, we gotta watch this. I've heard so much. We got to do it. We got to see it. And then I was a little disappointed. I think for one thing, the plot is I found to be very predictable. I feel like you expect there's certain things that you will expect to happen. Those things that you expect to happen inevitably happen. Like it doesn't take any like wild turns or anything. Not that it needs to, but like the direction that it very intentionally goes isn't very like, I feel like there's supposed to be these big reveals and they're not. At all, they're not super surprising. It does have some good scares, but it also has a lot of jump scares that just don't work. It falls into lots of cliches, and it also has some really brilliant stuff. Like there were scenes where I was really bored, right next to a scene where I was totally engaged. Like when we first meet Danny, the blind medium, she has a great scene where she kind of monologues about the stuff in her shop and how she can touch things. Like there's some scenes that work really well, but then they're next to scenes that are so boring that I was just like, oh, can we get on? Let's move past this. So it's up and down for me, but I think they're, yeah, I mean, hopefully it's the kind of thing that the director would get a better project from this afterwards.
Yeah, so cinematography is real locked down, almost like old Fincher, but without like the range of lenses that he has now. Like your camera is hardly ever moving. It is almost always on a tripod, locked. You're never even really panning. You're never zooming. It's real still. And our open is very quiet. It's this young woman in this house. There's a couple of odd things in it, like this tent she's got like up in kind of the entryway, but otherwise it's fine. And I was drawn in by its opening like engagement between her and this man outside. It's night. She's just gotten off the phone with her husband. He's working nights. He'll be back in the morning. So she's alone out there for the evening. She goes out to her car. She grabs something, comes back in, hears a noise at the door she has closed, opens up the peephole, and there's a man there, a creep, right? He's got this crazy hair and this wild eye. And he says, ma'am, you've got to come out. There's somebody in there with you. I saw him. They ran in. And she says, who are you? He says, I know your husband. I'm one of his patients. I'm telling you, there's someone in there. She says, you better leave or I'll call the police. He goes, please call him. Because there's somebody in there with you. There's somebody in the house. And it immediately presents this conundrum, right? Like, am I alone in here or is that guy crazy? And he told me he's a patient, so he is crazy. But is he crazy? Not like, it's good. And then the exploration of that, like down the rabbit hole, right? Meeting Danny and her shop of oddities and seeing these sets that are like so simple, so bare bones. Like the sets are, I mean, this entryway to this house is all you see of the house and a bedroom. So it's functionally one long set that they shoot on the upper and lower floor of. Like Danny's oddity shop is two walls. Like you never even see the whole place. You never see an exterior. They never show it. You see some insides of a hospital that's like not really a hospital, but they just retrofitted this old building, like just kind of make it work. And you're absolutely right about the tropes. It specifically, McCarthy said this in an interview from IMDb Trivia. He, quote, cherry-picked from horror tropes to make oddity. All kinds of stuff. So in that way, like, I do think it is a bit predictable. You see some scares coming for sure. But I'm still charmed by them. Like, I think the way it mixes them up, the way it blends them together, and again, no expectations. Like, I had a good time. I think it's a solid streaming feature for sure. It's the kind of thing you would see on like a Netflix or pop up on Hulu, Amazon Prime even. Even like Redbox back in the day would run something like Oddity. And like you would get it for a couple bucks and go, you know what? That was kind of neat. Like I didn't think it was going to be so simple, especially when it gets into its supernatural elements, which are like stunningly simple film wise. Like you're not getting any grand CGI. You're not getting any huge VFX. Like no, none of that. None of that's an Oddity.
I think what did interest me is like he has this overall thesis, which is this idea of how we automatically trust. It's about trust and power and how we automatically trust certain figures in our world, things like police, doctors and things, and how kind of that could be problematic in that how and vice versa is the way you would trust maybe a police officer over a homeless person. And while both people are both capable of great evil, but also great dignity. And so it's kind of challenging those notions of like where we just kind of automatically put our trust in people in certain professions. So that's a very interesting kind of central theme. And he does, that's what he's exploring, but it feels like it's centered around that. It's the movie centered around this theme and not like, well, let me think of a great story to tell along the way. It's a movie that feels like it, I've said this before, that's built backwards where he thought of a great ending and then built the rest of it instead of from forward to back.
Yeah, that's actually a really good read. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
The oddity stuff, I wished it just worked better. When we first meet Danny, she has this, tells this great story about this bell that summons. It's like an old hotel bell, and if you ring it, it'll summon like the dead bellboy that died because of it, something like that. And like that's great. It's a really good creepy story, and it's a object. And but then like the thing that she brings to the house is like this big wooden thing, and I was like, well, that's, I know exactly what that thing's gonna what that thing's gonna do, and I'm waiting the whole movie for it to happen.
Right. Pretty good cursed objects, I think, in Oddity, even though you don't see, well, you see a lot of them, but they don't have much use in the film. Really, her like curiosity shop is kind of like where these things are. There's even a segment like in the back with this like special ones on this wall. She's got like this haunted bellhop bell, and she's got the toy monkey from Jordan Peele's production house, like with the clanging cymbals, right? She's got one of those things in there. Yeah. And this like very odd, like wooden man that you may have seen in the marketing, like with this big screaming face. Like real creepy, real strange. And waiting to kind of see what's going to happen with these is a big part of it, right? Like that curiosity as you kind of lean into the screen and go, okay, what's going to happen here? So something's up for sure. I know I'm watching a horror movie. Like something's going to happen with this stuff. And slowly seeing these things come by one is a lot of fun. Additionally, you get a big benefit from this other character. What's her name? Yana. Yeah, this woman who's at this house where Danny is kind of like investigating what happened on the one year anniversary of her sister's demise. She's like trying to figure out what had happened and if she was okay when she passed. And Yana, who does not want to be there but is kind of inadvertently trapped because she can't find her car keys, she kind of plays like the audience. She doesn't know anything about this stuff. She doesn't believe in ghosts. She is creeped out by the wooden man and by Danny, and she slowly just becomes more and more unnerved by like the awful stuff that's going on. She reminds me of like a couple of the teenagers in Old Evil Dead, right, in the cabin. They're like, let's just get out of here. Let's just leave. You know, like it's a good time. Like good horror characters to have somebody kind of hanging out who doesn't agree with any of this and just wants to get out of here as fast as she can. So like that's one of those tropes that I think works well in the movie, but is also like very on the nose, predictable. Like you could see right through that character, paper thin, but fun in the best way.
Yeah, like I said, there are things at work. That there's parts that they have very combative dialogue between Yana and Danny. It's great when they're arguing and she's like, do I look stupid? Because you look stupid. Do you like, are you calling my sister stupid? Like it's very, very the claws are out between both of them. And that's the other thing. It's like, oh, the husband apparently has moved on and is now in a new relationship not long after with his new, much younger intern or whatever. And it's like, come on, man.
Yeah. Yeah. It bears its teeth a little early as far as the plot's concerned, which is a shame because, like I said, it does such a good job of building up these like cursed objects. And as like the day slowly creeps into night and the sun starts to go down and things start to get eerie around the house, like that stuff all is pretty good for what's there. But yeah, like I didn't think about it till we talked about it before the show. You're right. It really does kind of show you where it's going a little too early, a little tightening up in the script. That's all. Little something.
Yeah. I mean, it's a low budget thing. You know, that means low budget script is well, like, few more passes, it could have been more polished. Like I said, there's some great scenes or some moments that are genuinely creepy. And then there's things that are just really tropes or just there to get from point A to point B and doesn't make a lot of sense. And so it's a bit of a mixed bag.
Well, let's wrap this up. I want to make sure we get to the end of it. Andy, would you recommend Oddity?
I would say save it for streaming if you have something like Shudder. I think horror heads will probably dig it. Just if you're a fan of horror, it does have some good moments. And if it is more available now than it has been. I wonder if my opinion would have been different had I seen it without any hype. But who knows? So I think, again, your mileage may vary. Save it for streaming.
Yeah, it's on Shudder now. I would recommend for streaming. I think streaming is kind of the perfect place to watch it. I feel like if I had gone to see it in theaters, I'd be pleased by the runtime, but maybe a little disappointed that like it didn't get grander in vision or scope. But like watching it at home, like cozy on the couch under a blanket, it's a good time, dude. Like would recommend. I think Shudder's fun. Shudder. I think Oddity is fun, and it's available on Shudder, where there's also a bunch of other movies for October. Not sponsored by Shudder. Don't know why I'm plugging them, but that's the show. That's episode 269 of Off Script. My God, already behind us. I'm so glad we got to talk about Megalopolis. Andy, what are we watching next week?
Next week is a big week. Joker Folie à Deux, aka Joker 2, aka Joker Shared Madness, comes out this week. It's the huge follow-up from 2019's Joker. That was a $1 billion film. I don't think this is going to be a $1 billion film. It's gotten kind of mixed reviews. So we're going to check it out, see what all that's about. I'm definitely excited to see that. Loved Joaquin Phoenix as Joker. Loved Lady Gaga. We're also going to be taking a look at The Wild Robot, which I've seen, but is, I think, a great film. I'm not going to get into it too much, but it was number one at the box office. It's a good, friendly family film. And in case you don't know, just the real quick, the premise is a robot kind of crash lands in this forest and has to raise a duckling, a gosling, in order to fly in time for the migration. And there's lots of fun. There's great animation, great score, lots of stuff. Yeah. We'll get into it more next week.
Vivid visuals is what I recall from the Wild Robot trailer. I was like, oh, dude, like huge colors, like big stuff, like looks like a really good time. Lupita Nyong'o at the front. Can't wait to see her again. And of course,
I'll put this under our FYI releases. Salem's Lot is going to be out on Max this weekend as well. Starting off, kicking off our Halloween weekend, a remake of that property based on the book by Stephen King. That's only 2 hours and not 3 hours like the 1979 version. So that's going to be out on Max. And some other ones, A Different Man, starring Sebastian Stan, and The Outrun also released today. Those are probably going to be real small or limited release, rather. The Outrun is Saoirse Ronan's starring, but also her directorial debut about a London party girl who battles addiction in her homeland of Scotland.
Oh, I didn't know she directed that. Shoot, I'm going to check that out. Yeah, and also stoked to check out Joker. God, we're seeing that in 70mm IMAX. One of 11 prints in the country. Stoked to watch it. We'll report on the top and bottom of the screen and tell you how good it won't look on the Blu-ray, because they probably won't have that version out. But it'll be rad. I'm stoked to see it. It's going to be a good time. If you enjoyed the show today, Offscript episode 269, best way to support us is just subscribe. Subscribe to the show on your favorite platform, wherever you're watching and or listening right now. Audio listeners, Google Play, Spotify, iHeartMedia, Amazon Music. Hit that sub button, man. You thought about it before. You've been here. You've been in these shoes. You've been in this place. You can also leave a rating and review. That'd be a huge help as well. Comment if you're able. I know a couple of those services can do it. Let us know what you think, man. We read them. I swear. We follow up. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, all the usual social media places. You can give us a follow over there as well. You can lay us a hit us with a comment as well, and we're on YouTube. Big things happening on YouTube. You can check out what we got going on over there. Let's see. You can check out our website, offscriptfilmreview.com, and you can email us correspondence directly at mail@offscriptfilmreview.com. From all of us at Offscript, the home of Bold Cinema, I'm Zach Lewis.
And I'm Dr. Draper.
Thanks for watching.